talk about WebVac. Who remembers the case? Anyone? A name tag. You nameless.
My name is Nikita.
Nikita. Start, why don't you start us off with the case?
Well, WebVan was a company started by a guy who started Borders books. He had a vision that he's gonna WebVan's gonna be gonna provide the last mile delivery. Yep. So they're gonna deliver. They're gonna pick up where e-commerce currently or presently left off at the warehouse and deliver groceries actually to consumers within 30 minutes. With precision of 30 minutes, and they wanted to be one or three companies that would be quote unquote welcome in consumers' home.
Okay, groceries in 30 minutes. What else was the WebVan idea? Yes, one.
They wanted to own the last mile. They wanted to.
What does that mean?
So they want to be a company that delivers people's homes, more like PRSA, that can establish a relationship with shopping that will later on be grown so they can sell all the types of items. They want to go, you know, swing for the fences, grow as large as needed, because they're going to be, you know, serving in all their target markets with all kinds of foods. So it's a very strong retail operation. It sounds like the Borders founder actually had already began a year before he even starts on the web an idea to deal with retail automation in a different company. And it sounds to me a little bit of like half hammer and nail kind of thing.
Good. Bro?
He wanted to provide groceries, and the idea would be more pressure and there would be a wider choice than
Why, were they going to grow them there? How are they going to be fresher?
I think they're going to test them fewer number of times.
Okay. Anybody else? Chris.
They're also selling our convenience via the idea of cost savings and they can pass on to
the. Heck, was that one of their ideas? Cheaper? Did they say cheaper?
So lower cost.
Lower cost to who?
To the buyer.
But, I mean, was it cheaper to the consumer? Or?
Yes.
Well,
I think yes. Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, great.
So, I mean, they wanted to start with groceries, but the grand vision was to virtualize the supermarket.
Okay. Virtualize the supermarket. I like that. Uh-huh.
Right,
we'll talk about customers and target market in a second, but hold that idea, you're right in the back.
One aspect was also to collect data
about the. That's a detail. Did we cover their big idea yet, or no? More about big idea, yes?
They're also trying to get as many consumers as possible to begin with.
So, big idea. Ashley.
I think the eventual goal of the founders actually sell everything that can be sold online, so books. That's why they have.
Right. Yep, I think so.
I think also lower cost.
Lower cost, yep. Yep, I agree. All right. Good. Did we cover it? Or anything else, Kevin?
Wasn't a lot of it the reason they spent so much money on the center? Well, they thought that they could cover the amount of ground out of one facility that it takes. I think it was 20 or so
for supermarkets. Yeah. We'll get to that in a second. Yes, Eric?
I guess if you're looking at the idea,
you're right.
You know, one idea was that that the time that someone spends going to the supermarket or really any store has some economic value to the person actually going to the store.
And so what was their idea?
That they were going to be able to... Maybe somehow arbitrage that value.
I mean, they thought there was value in eliminating some time spent shopping, no? Isn't that what you just said? Yeah. Right? Or else why use the damn service at all? Right? The rest was all about what they're going to do, but they actually had a implicit notion about one of the big ideas, right? And that's not completely stupid, because who was actually in business at the time? Anybody know? No, who else? Not in groceries. Amazon. Right? I mean, Amazon didn't do anything other than give you an inventory of the bookstore, right? But it eliminated this. And there was some magic about that. Okay. So, yes. Good point.
One big thing is that they try to computerize everything, like forecasting, distribution, and so on. They brought some advanced processes.
Yep.
It's another way of saying what Eric said was they assume that they are going to...
But if you say it twice, you get extra credit, right? You're in business school.
Yeah. Yeah. They assume that they're going to change customers' behavior of going to shopping.
I agree. Chris, did you have an idea?
No.
But you'll defer to me. Right? And whatever he said, you'll get credit for.
Is Sector really trying to optimize the entire supply chain from packaged goods?
Yep. I agree. From end to end. Anybody else? I think you guys covered most of the big ideas here. When's this occurring? What year? Anybody remember? The case? Yeah. Just for context setting, anybody remember?
Near grade school or...
Yeah. Your parents told you about this era. Anybody remember what was going on? Anybody ever looked? Was anybody working during the internet bubble? What was it like? Anybody, you know? Rodrigo?
It was great. Came in 99 and there were, like, everybody was trying to snatch up programmers of any kind. We would do our own parties and throw away our money.
Okay.
Money was cheap.
Money was cheap.
The same.
Yep.
It was great. I was in New York, and there was a competitor, a web app sort of, called Urban Fetch.
Mm-hmm.
They use the same marketing business. You call to get whatever you want, basically, like a movie. And they send free ice cream and candy bars and t-shirts. $5 for
Well, they adopted that in the subprime mortgage business 10 years later. The same effect. What else was visible then?
A lot of companies are going IPO because of these problems.
Thank you. There were liquidity. Huge, that is, there was comparable cash because there was huge liquidity events. Does anybody remember how huge? Anybody? I mean, billions, IPOs worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. So I just want to set the scene here. These guys were thinking big because it would add like two or three zeros to anything you know about today. Let's, in fact, that gets us to our next subject. What's GBF? Have you ever heard that phrase? Not used too often today. Get big fast. Right? And what's the other one? FMA.
First mover advantage.
Thank you. Someone been looking at history. GBF and FMA were what your boards were telling you all the time. Get big fast and first mover advantage. Anybody know what the theory of first mover advantage was? Anyone guess? Yes.
It's like a network effect, so you just going to count a bunch of customers and have them in your system.
Uh-huh.
Your approach. That way you can call that acquiring customers first, and then the larger you are, that's a competitive advantage because you would obtain a large base of customers that is a networking effect for your system or product.
Okay. Capture most customers first, network effect, yes?
That's the experience.
The experience curve. And what about it?
So you start running the business before anybody else is running it, and you learn more about how to run it, how to be more efficient, and how to be better at it. So if you put it behind, just stay behind. It can never be as efficient as the main company.
Okay. Anybody else?
It was also like naming the category.
You got to name the TLA, right? You remember what TLA is? You bet. Name slash define the category. Anybody else? What else?
The team cost maybe once the customers are going to market, but I'm here to make it
get big mass, you may reward you get
scale on this.
Okay. Economies of scale. What else? What else about customers are a piece of here? In which we kind of say capture most customers. What's another word to say? To another phrase to describe
market
that.
Share.
Say it again.
Market share.
Market share. Right? The goal of most first mover advantage strategies were market share. What does this imply about a first mover advantage? If you believe in a market share strategy.
But there's a clear market.
Good. Let's write that down. Assumes an understood market. What else does it assume?
Rapid adoption rate.
Thank you. What else does it assume?
Money
to be made. We'll talk about that in this case. Absolutely correct. Shadow? I'm sorry? Yeah? What else?
Accessible,
yes. What else?
Defend it.
You could defend it, yeah. Anything else?
The key is the economy of scale. At some point, I think you look a little fast. At some point, it economy of scale.
All correct. But let me just, yes.
Is it to assume that in a given market, small players won't survive?
Yes. So it assumes that you understand the market, rapid adoption matters, and size matters. And even more about size matters, you're all kind of backing into, I mean, these are all correct, nothing wrong with it. But the killer about first mover advantage is, let's just take the Webvan case. What market did they think they were in? What market? Just for the sake of you were Webvan. Who were you going after? Did they buy cars?
Retail.
Groceries. Right? Just for the sake of that for a second. They bought groceries. Well, what percentage of grocery buyers do you think they could get in the first year? How many grocery buyers are there in the United States? How many are there?
300 million.
Well, so let's do the math. Okay. How many below the age of 18 and above the age of, you know, like no longer ambulatory, right? So what do we think the number really is? About
150 million.
I love it. Divide the market in half, right? That's 150 million, all right? Or how many households are there in the US? No.
20 million.
Come on, you're marketeers. You're
120 million.
Yeah, somewhere between 80 and 120 million. I think those are the number of households, right? Divide average number of people divided by 320 million. Is that how many people we have in the U.S.? All right. If you're Webvan in the most optimistic forecast, how many households can you get in year one?
They're swimming for
1%. Great. What's that number?
600,000.
Let's take that. Let's just say it's 600,000. How many households does that leave? How many does it leave that you didn't get? Yeah, it's a rounding error, isn't it? I mean, I just want you guys to do the first mover advantage math here that says, well, wait a minute. If we're building this out so fast, to make sure no one else gets first mover advantage because of everything you said, gee, high switching cost and whatever. Wait a minute. There are still 99 million other customers. So what's the reason for these guys going for first mover advantage?
I thought that they probably defined the market differently.
Great. And how did they define their market?
It's an online grocery shop.
Great. How many of those?
1% and 60,000.
So in fact, they were trying to get 100% of a very small market? That wasn't going to grow? I don't know. I'm asking.
Probably what they thought could affect
the change in consumer behavior. Right? Maybe all they thought they could get in the first year were the crazy crazies, and that if they didn't get them, no one else did, so they will buy it, right? Could be. Yeah.
Well, they had a strong regional strategy. They wanted to make sure that they could capture the market in the Bay Area for people that are looking to online shop. So I think they defined the whole market as very big, but it wasn't realistic to go after the rural areas.
Yeah.
So it wasn't.
I think they were expecting the phenomenon to catch on, and then a lot of people went on hearing more and more and falling into this trap.
Yeah.
I'm not defending them, but about the 100% of this market. They were estimating the market at about 63 million, and they were expecting to have 10 to 12% of that market.
Okay.
Not 100%. Yeah. But I still don't like them.
Hey, if, you know, somebody bought their stock for a while. Yeah.
Just back to those comments. So, I think they were also betting on the households, but those households were tech savvy or go online and be willing to order. So in a sense, that percentage of that overall market, so the addressable market that they had was much less than the overall households. So even if we take, let's say, that's 10% or 20% of US was probably had computers and they wanted to order things online, or they're used to Amazon, for example.
Ah, so there was a total available market of every household, and there was a potential served available market of people who had internet in 1999. Is that what you're telling me? Which was a Venn diagram like subset. Is that correct?
I think they were planning to get the early adopters,
adopters
promoted.
And they were going to rush to do that, right? I mean, that's what the case is. Hold on to your hats for a while. Yeah, Raj.
There is also the education that needs to happen because not everybody is used to money.
Smart man.
Once the product is out there, then people...
We'll talk about that in a second. In fact, let me jump to this side of the board for a second. We're going to get back to this. Key part of the internet startup culture, both in 2000 and still. What was their business model? Somebody take me through what their fundamentals are of their business. It's buried in the case, just kind of extract. Anybody want to start? Dave, you were kind of nodding like you were ready to rock and roll. In fact, you mentioned it earlier.
I remember it in the case. I didn't have the numbers written down.
Can you give me a generic how this stuff, you know, how they make money? Come on. Go look at the case. Yes.
People make orders on the internet. They buy these goods from the supplier,
yeah.
Stock it in distribution centers, and then sell it and distribute it to those consumers.
Yep. So there's a warehouse. Somewhere there's food suppliers. Anybody remember any of the numbers for any of this? Anywhere in the case?
They expected something like 8,000 orders per day.
Okay. They expected just here. 8,000 orders per day.
And
yeah.
On average, about $100 per order.
Yeah.
And this is per distribution center.
Right. So their average order size, right?
Right. So it would equal about $300 million per year per distribution center.
This all across. $300 million a year per distribution center. May I remember any other data about customers or business buried in the case? Take a look. Anything about their assumptions? Yes.
Yeah, and they said they needed 3,600 orders per day to break even.
They needed how many?
3,300 to 3,600 orders per day at the Oakland Distribution Center to break even. They dropped that later, I think, 2,900 to 3,300.
Okay.
They need about 3,000 orders a day just to break even.
Okay, yes.
They were shooting for operating profits of 12% of sales, which is 3 times what the average also with you.
Okay. Anybody else?
Dave, then the real estate cost of 1% of revenues?
Okay.
6%.
Pretty good, huh?
They were, hold on a second.
Yes.
They were going to charge customers an additional fee for, they were going to give customers, that there was going to be no delivery cost for orders over $75.
Okay. Were there any delivery costs initially? You may remember. They charged $4.95. By the way, anybody remember what a typical supermarket brought in? $12 million a year. Okay. Yes.
So they assume that the area they see would reduce their labor cost by a factor of 10
for right.
similar scale.
Yep. Back.
Gross margins were 27%.
Okay. Yep.
So they want to carry finally 50,000 items, but I think the 99 they were still at 16,000 to 18,000.
Great. Man, this is impressive. I would have invested, yeah.
They assume that their customers would switch 100% of their grocery purchases to them and make 2.4 trips or orders per week, I guess, leaving 10% of their annual income at work.
Okay.
They assume that they could get to the break-even level within 5 quarters.
Man, I really like this perspective.
5 quarters.
Hey, yes.
The follow-up 2.4s and left, it actually turned out to be 1.6. Mm.
Okay. That's pretty good, I think. Yep. Any other facts?
I think it was 1.6 orders per month.
Per month or per week? Oh, this was supposed to be per week, and this was
supposed to
be
first month.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So wait a minute. So let's just do that. That's
0.4,
right? Let's just keep apples and apples, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, so that kind of affects the number of customers they have.
Does, doesn't it? Yeah. She?
Also, the number of deliveries, instead of 4 to 6, they could only deliver 3 in an hour.
Uh-huh.
That affected how many people they could serve.
So how many did they think they could deliver?
4 to 6.
Right. And what did they actually do?
3.
Okay.
What I love is this 30-minute delivery window.
Domino's.
I'd rather not be a big deal. Their customers said 60 was just fine.
Yeah.
And a big issue in terms of cost.
30-minute delivery. Did anybody in this class actually ever get the experience of using WebVan? Tell me about it.
So it was good that you could actually get the delivery, but you always had trouble finding a spot at night when you just came back from the office. You could just let them in the truck. Then later they started doing things like keep it with your neighbor, so you could do strange things like
that. But you can find a delivery spot.
Right.
Okay.
So, and you know, it was like, you know, you always had to see like 3-4 days in advance.
And were you the one who ordered the guy, or did you have a spouse or a partner?
Both.
Okay. And how about you, Fred?
I had a good experience. I was actually a student here at Berkeley. I didn't have a car, so I made grocery shopping a lot this year.
Good. Anybody else? Just as an aside, I did it, and I did it with my. And I thought it was the coolest thing on the planet. My wife hated it. What was their business assumption about who their customers would be?
Soccer moms.
Affluent soccer mom. Anybody, I don't want to play sexist roles here, but given that that was their business model, any women in the class want to tell me why they wouldn't order from them? Anybody have an opinion?
Because
Yeah. Back. Megan.
Personally, I love to cook, and I really like to see what I'm getting and go to the store and feel it.
Okay. Ashley?
Well, a lot of the time shopping in the grocery store is like an experience. We want to just go there and like, eat it, touch it, eat it, cook it. So that's the part experience is missing.
Or?
I like to compare on prices, so I like having a broader selection of all the different brands.
And would you like that on web end or in the store?
In the store.
In the store. Anybody else? Any? Yeah? Or?
I would just say, I think I have a lot of time planning in advance. A lot of time it's the last minute. I'm running out of time. I'll go to the store if I can now.
Okay. And again, I don't want to make, go, oh, go ahead.
I would hate seating in the computer instead of choosing.
Okay. Any other women comments? And I don't want to, no, seriously, I don't want to make this a sexist or gender-based thing, but that was one of their assumptions, was based on who their customers would be. And I have to tell you, that for you guys who haven't noticed, men and women do shop differently as a, you know, every stereotype sometimes has a basis in fact. Yes?
Also, women like to use coupon.
I'm sorry?
They do grocery shopping,
right.
But women who can't.
Right. I mean, to guys, I have to tell you, to me, it was a technical decision, right? Oh, look, you know, there's the strawberries. And my wife would go, what do you mean there's the strawberries? You know, you got to smell them. I want strawberries. Quick, you said strawberries on the list. You know, grapefruit. You know, you can't pick a grapefruit like that. And I mean, it was, you know, it's been 30 years and we still have these, like, what planet are you on? Mutually. And WebVan actually brought the best out of that discussion of, and then I realized that I think, as a good number of you pointed out, anybody ever been with a spouse or significant other clothing shopping? Have you ever noticed? Some of you are laughing. You understand that, you know, for guys, it's, I could be done in 9 minutes for an entire wardrobe. And for my wife, she doesn't get through the entrance. And we now kind of understand that that has nothing to do with, you know, mental capability of spending money. It's just a different set of enjoyment, whereas I could go to a hardware store or Fry's and not leave until 4 hours later with $3,000 worth of equipment. And you can't even get my wife into the entryway of Fry's. Anybody ever notice this, or is it just me? So sometimes there's gender-based decisions in retail, but I only point it out here because they made a specific business model assumption here. So who was the woman on their management team who made that decision? So I look at the appendix and point out who the woman on the management team was who made that decision. I'm sorry? Well, there must be a woman on the management. She must be head of food selection, right? Or market? Who was it? Everybody see the appendix on WebVan tape? Is there a page 19? Any women on the management team there? No? No women. Well, that's interesting. I guess Louis Borders understood, based on his gender-based experience in book selling. So let's just point out that they had an assumption about gender preferences. Which were kind of interesting. Oh, by the way, since we're on Appendix Exhibit 1 on page 19, anybody else see something interesting about the management team? Anything strike you about that team? World-class team. Dave?
A real great experience with great big firms.
Yes. Okay, no entrepreneurs. Megan?
And they don't have any food experience.
No food experience. Screw food experience. We're building something bigger, Megan. Why do I need anybody with food experience?
Because you're handling a different type of product that has to be turned rapidly and needs totally different distribution.
Those grocery people, Megan, are dinosaurs. They don't get it. They don't get it. What do you say?
It might be valuable.
Big idea. Let me tell you, if you're an entrepreneur, whoever goes near me and says, let me tell you how those idiots in insert name of industry here doesn't get it, you'll see me slowly backing away quickly. And the reason why is you might have some killer insight on how to put industry X, Y, and Z out of business, but you lack the experience to realize what you really want to hire is an SOB from that business who actually shares your view. And you want that expertise on how to kill an old business by having some great old people in your company who's lived it, who also might agree with you. In fact, the best place to find those people are in large companies who have lived it for 30 years and have also concluded their business is going out of business. So, for example, if today you have the final killer nail of how to put the newspapers out of business so they're doing a great job by themselves, where should you get one of your co-founders? At least my theory is out of the newspaper business, and probably you could get, like, most of them for free now because they're about to be all unemployed starting tomorrow. Thank you, Megan. Any other observations? Yes. Sorry.
Last one, you phrased Sequoia and others. And wished them to be on board, and this time they are part of investors. Yes. I'm sure they have some women.
Yes. Is there a Sequoia partner here?
I'm not a partner.
I won't even go there. And your point is?
What was their role, and how come they didn't say?
We'll get to that in a second, and hold that thought. I think it's a great thought. Yes?
Not to diminish your previous point, but they actually had a person who was in retail food and who was a vice president of Lucky Stores.
Yes. And what's their title?
Distribution.
Yep, great. And what are they doing here? The distribution centers, perfect. What are they doing? What's the goal here?
Company's goal?
No, on distribution centers. What's their goal? Why did I build these things?
Efficiency.
Okay. Anybody have any idea how much a distribution center costs?
$49.99.
Yeah, I'm getting a bidding war here. We started at 35, we're up to 50. It says so in the case they bought some new ones. Anybody remember? Take a look at the case.
Well, they entered that agreement with Bechtel for $1 billion.
$1 billion for how many?
26.
$1 billion. Oh, man. This is a startup. All right. Kind of fun. Let's talk about what happened. Just hope we're not drawing this for you 10 years from now. What happened? We know they went out of business. We know they ran out of cash, blah, blah, blah. What happened? Yes?
First, they did not question their assumption. One big assumption they made is incapacity.
And what was their capacity assumption?
Their capacity assumption was... I don't remember, but
somebody
18 supermarkets, DT is as big as 18 supermarkets.
I think somebody said the key one was 8,000 customers a day, and they actually got 3,600, right? Is that the key assumption, or one of them?
I got less.
They got fewer.
All right. 2,000 a day. And then the average orders, they expected how many? 2.4 a month, and they got 0.4 or something? Is that about
for a week.
For a week, and they got
0.4. 2.4 a week, and they got 0.4.
So there is one thing they said here about capacity that was really, I think they should have struck them from the very first day.
Yeah.
When they said that, you know, that their DDs, when it operates at its full capacity or the designed capacity, mm-hmm. Their inventory turnover will be 24 times annually,
yep.
compared to 9 to 11 times in traditional supermarkets.
Yep.
So what they didn't think about is that this inventory turnover in traditional supermarket is determined basically by customer demand. There is no capacity or food shortage here in the United States to begin. I don't go to the supermarket to buy cucumber and I don't find cucumber. So this 9 to 11 times inventory turned over is defined by demand. And now they are designing something that will raise it to 24 times. This should tell them the very first thing that our capacity assumption is wrong.
Something else that you just raised too, and it might not be obvious. Does everybody know about inventory turns? Yeah? Can somebody give us a definition of inventory turns? Am I an inventory expert? Come on. Somebody. You've all nodded, so be careful. You're all nodding. Rah, 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 rah. Now he's going to call me and ask me, all right, Patrick.
How many times you sell your entire stock inventory per year?
Great. And so what's better? So a smaller number or larger?
You want high inventory.
You want high inventory turns, right? You'd love to have 300 your inventory turns to be 365, which means what?
Every day
you're turning inventory. Now, if I don't turn my MacBook Pro in inventory, what happens to that MacBook Pro a week from now? Still there. Happens if I don't turn my tomatoes?
Still there.
What's the value of the tomato? Fertilizer. Zero. Inventory turns for perishable commodities. It's very different than inventory turns from packaged goods. One second. By the way, what's the most perishable item past groceries? No, past groceries. Past groceries. But banana's pretty good, but past groceries, different industry.
Electronics.
Sorry?
Electronics.
Past electronics. Past pharmaceuticals. What perishes? Sometimes hourly. What kind of service? News? What else? Yes. Wasn't even thinking about that, but that one's good. Airline seats. Right? That airplane takes off, that inventory's gone. Right? Who figured out how to arbitrage airline seats? I remember?
Priceline.
Priceline said, duh, you know, you're flying with that empty plane, have I got a deal for you? Just as an aside, inventory turns in different industries mean something different. Some of it, well, you know, you're getting obsolete goods eventually. Some of it, your goods are obsolete, like, in about 3 days when those bananas go bad. And some of it, when that plane takes off, you don't get to ever sell that inventory again because it just took off whatever's on that plane. Hopefully it's all coming back down on the ground at the same time. But, all right, you had a comment.
You were supposed to say that they were trying to use suppliers to deliver just in time. So
yes.
List
right. So this was an ultimate just-in-time play. Yes, Rodrigo.
Part of the dev spiral is that they assumed that the bottleneck for the whole system was in actually selecting the items, and it turned out to be of the delivery window. So they wanted to operate 8 to 5 Monday to Friday, and they ended up having to extend that to like all weekend, and they still didn't have the utilization.
Right. Your problem. You wanted your food when you came home from work, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What else? What else were some of the key assumptions?
They invested heavily in the technology, the carousel system, which they thought was a good competitive advantage for them. And it turned out only the slow-moving good, which was 35% of the orders, were actually handled by the carousel, which, again, didn't really work well.
So in the DC, right, they built the world's most... Anybody ever see pictures or YouTube videos of the web van carousels? Anybody ever see this stuff? Awesome, right? Absolutely right out of, like, and I remember the movie Brazil. I mean, it's like just one of those bizarre. And what did they find? Say it again. What did they find, whoever made that count?
What they found was, like, it was just moving the slow-moving goods, which were only accounted for 35% of the.
So they invested hundreds of millions of dollars in this technology because, man, wouldn't it be cool to pick and pack by robot your tomatoes? You know, when in fact it was cheaper to do it with human beings. Oops. What else was oops?
I think one of the big reasons was they did not wait to test out this hypothesis, you know, in one DC and then expand to other areas. They started doing that sometimes.
But they did. When did they test the hypothesis? Tells you the case. When did they do it?
They tested it for 1 month before they launched.
Great. What happened? What was it called? Or what page was that on? The whole question.
It was early on in the other.
Anybody remember?
Something, yeah.
Find it in the case.
May of 99.
Great. What page are you on?
Page 2 in the bottom.
Okay. Yep, and there's another section as well. You may remember. I think.
Page 8.
Yeah, where's that?
Page 10.
Somewhere in here, it tells us that they actually had a beta test right before their IPO. And so they actually had customer data. In fact, they had customer data that said all this right before their IPO. What did they do when they had that data? Patrick, any idea?
Kept it proprietary.
What did they do?
So they thought that this is natural because they are just starting and it will just continue to what they guessed in the very first place.
And what else did they do?
Reached out to them.
Yeah, they did. Yep. What else?
They committed $1 billion.
You bet. They committed $1 billion to more warehouses. And then what else did they do? A month later. Month before their IPO, what did they do? They went public. Went public. Why? Why? They needed money. Who needed money? Who needed money?
Company did to pay for the $1 billion.
Of course, yes. The company.
And
who else?
The investors as well.
Oh, really? Investors wanted money?
Yeah, the people are throwing cheap money at you. Why not?
Full stop. What kind of environment was this in 99?
Super frothy.
Super what?
Frothy.
Frothy. The world's most incredible bubble for the tech business that none of you will ever live to see again. Maybe, but I doubt it. Okay? Because now there are laws against it. It was a huge bubble. It was a huge bubble, and the company had built up a huge burn rate, right? They needed to feed the machine. But to be fair, what do you think was going on in the board meeting? Think they wanted to, like, analyze these numbers? What do you think the board was saying? Where do you think this stuff came from? Think the founders came up with this? Who was saying this? Investors. Get big fast, first mover advantage. You really want to know where this came from, by the way? Shh, don't tell anybody. Turned out there was a professor at Stanford in 1989 who actually wrote a paper, and I still have it if somebody wants a copy of it, called First Mover Advantage. It's now pulled from his website. Because 3 years later, after he got beat up by a whole bunch of other professors worldwide, he actually published a second paper, which you can find, called First Mover Parens Disadvantage? Question mark. Unfortunately, there were two students in his business school class who kind of liked that first mover advantage stuff. Now, I happen to know this because my wife was in that class with them. They ended up co-founding a firm called Benchmark Capital, who needed a differentiator against Kleiner Perkins, whose butt they said they were going to kick up and down Silicon Valley. And so Benchmark started popularizing first mover advantage. It's a strategic differentiation of our firm. Not out of malice, because they actually thought that this made a lot of sense. Everybody in Silicon Valley in the bubble, if you were on Sand Hill Road, would tell you you weren't raising enough money, you weren't spending fast enough, and you weren't a real CEO if you couldn't, like, raise and spend $100 million. Trust me, this was the culture and environment at the time. So let's not completely blame WebVan. But let's now know something they didn't. For the last 2 weeks, we've been talking about market type. Back all the way up. You know more than WebVan ever did. What market type is the company? Or let me ask first, what market type did they think they were? What market type did the founders, the board members, and the execs think they were in, given the path and the money they spent? Let's just take a vote. Existing. Resegmenting. New. Okay. Let's start with new. Did you say new, Lauren? Mm-hmm. Dependent.
So that they're going to be the ones who get access to the customers in their homes through the online portal. So they were changing the pattern of the customer's behavior so that they're going to be purchasing online and that they're also going to get more products, new products than they've ever had before.
Perfect. Okay. Somebody, good. It's good argument. Somebody else tell me new. And with any different?
The whole idea of first mover advantage, assume that there's a market going on. So I would say.
Well, that's not new, is it? Well, that's not the definition of new. Right? New market. I said defend the new market. Who wants to defend new market? Yes?
No competition. They felt like they were.
Great. Right. No competition.
No competition.
No competition, new market. Great. Absolutely. I agree. That's the definition of new market. Somebody tell me why they think they're in an existing market.
Well, people were buying groceries before and they're going to buy them now.
Right. Existing market, we're just a different but bigger, better grocery store. Yes?
Sure.
Okay. But we knew what groceries were, right?
Their comparisons also, they always compared themselves with the grocery stores. Okay, grocery stores have 9 to 10. Turnovers, we're going to have 24. So the way they always measure themselves is also against the traditional or existing market.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else want existing? Yes.
I think that is an existing market because they are not producing at all in the market. They're producing in the execution. If we're doing things faster and better, we get it. It's on our side.
Why else would you spend $1 billion, right? They're spending money like drunken sailors. They assume there's an existing market. All I need to do is spend and execute, and the revenue curve will follow. Has to be. Can't be any other reason, right? Somebody? Yes?
I think the idea started different. If we look at the Borders business plan, he was thinking of something else in the beginning.
But what are they executing on?
Yeah, but so when he was thinking of a new market, but they happened to find themselves stuck in the grocery market. So he was thinking, he thought of Walmart and Borders because he was talking about the super centers and the online business. So he was thinking of having a virtual Walmart. But what he ended up building is a monster, a physical monster that is orders of magnitude bigger than Walmart. So he didn't build the virtual DC. Which would have been a new idea if it was implemented in a different way.
You should have been his consultant. No, seriously, should have been his consultant. Who thought they were resegmenting the market? Somebody did. Yes.
Maybe that's what I think.
Yeah.
because it's grocery stores, people are still buying groceries, but they wanted people to do it in a different way, so have a niche, people going online.
So your point is it could have been the grocery business, but the tech-savvy, internet-savvy grocery buyer. And could have been guys rather than his mistaken women, but there could have been a segment of the grocery business that really did want to buy online, and it was the grocery business. That's your point.
Yeah.
Yeah? Anybody else believe that? Yeah?
Yeah, so, I think it was resegmented because you were looking at this niche that it wasn't actually faster or cheaper. Because you had to wait, or at some point, instead of just going to the store to get food, and you couldn't use, they didn't use coupons, at least for a long time. So you were looking at this niche who didn't want food at a cheaper price and wanted to, and could afford to wait, at some point to get food that they want.
Yeah. So now let's go back and deconstruct each one. And by the way, there is no right answer, but I want you to at least start thinking. Characteristics of a new market. Let's forget WebVan for a second. Now, for those of you who pick new, in fact, Lauren, I'll pick on you again, because there wasn't anything wrong with what you said. But remind me what you remember about a new market.
That there are no competitors.
Right, no competitors.
Nobody really knows what the product is.
Great. And so what else can you infer about a new market? Not about WebFam, just about a new market. What are sales like in a new market?
You just never know who the customer is going to be and what the sales projection is going to look like.
Right. And so what else can you infer about sales? Yes. Yeah, why? Yeah. Okay. All right. Anybody now want to change their new market view? Anybody? No? No, I'm not talking you out of it. Why would you want to change your mind?
Well, because they haven't already identified existing competitors. They think that they do know who their customers are. They're operating under the assumption that they know about the market already.
So one could observe, and let me just make some observations. Again, there's no right answer. They're certainly executing like these guys are in an existing market. By definition, is there any contemplation going on here by the case? Anybody like thoughtful in this case?
I mean, you could argue that they were setting the distribution channel, which was the internet, the process of taking order on the internet and setting that, and they were not really into the grocery business.
But the point I want to make is, what were they doing? What were they doing?
Building.
What were they doing?
Building the brand.
What were they just assuming?
They're just rolling the infrastructure out as if, building hotels or something, as if the customers exist and they're just going to come.
Brilliant. They were executing. Remember I made the point, the difference between learning and discovery and execution? Forget about the bubble for a second. And I love this case because it's every bad thing that could happen to a startup magnified by 1,000. Right? Because of the bubble, not because they were 1,000 times stupider than you guys. You guys will make your equivalent versions of this in your career, trust me. I've got at least 4 of them. But what happens here in the case is they are executing as per what? Where'd they... What's the document they're executing off of? Their business plan. Oops. Any facts here? None. In fact, there is facts at a period of time. When did they gather some facts? You remember, Elena? You remember when they got some facts?
Well, when they did the test trial?
Yeah, they had a test trial. They had some facts. Boy, were those inconvenient. Just execution. It's a big idea. This is a failure writ large by billions of dollars by very smart people, exasperated or blown up by a bubble. By a bubble that just said, man, if we could cash out, doesn't matter how stupid and wrong we are, there's some other idiots who will own the stock, and maybe it'll all work out well. Only one of these I could think of that worked out well, that scaled past any sane reason. Anybody know what company it was that's still in business today doing fine? Amazon. Everybody kind of knows that. eBay was doing fine and was profitable from day one. Only company that had this vision that actually nailed it after they did get scale was Amazon. Every other big idea like this. In fact, let me give you the example. Anybody remember the 2000 Super Bowl ads? Anybody remember those? Nikita, you're laughing. Do you remember?
No.
Yeah, what were they? PetSmart, Pets.com,
E-Trade,
who else? Yeah, but sock puppets. I mean, that was the... My contention is we ran a $1 trillion science experiment during the internet bubble. Truly, $1 trillion. And the science experiment was as follows. I think, if you ask my opinion, and that's all it is that WebVan was an extreme. They executed hundreds of millions of dollars like they were in an existing market. But the reality was they were in a new market. Maybe they could have been resegmented. And how you know you're in a new market, and they, to me, proved it, is if you pour infinite dollars into that marketplace and you could barely move the dial about customer adoption, it ain't you. It's about the adoption. And therefore, that to me is a characteristic of a new market. I'll give it to you, Lauren. Will you use it? Would you have used Webvan if I gave it to you?
Yeah, I used Peapod.
All right, you're the wrong. All right. Would you have used it if you couldn't squeeze the vegetable?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Right. Thank you. Sorry. No. But do you see what I'm saying? I mean, run the science experiment in your head. If you could, I gave it to you, and you still won't use it because there are other reasons. Here, anybody ever hear about Shutterfly or any of those companies in the beginning? Can I tell you this? Can I tell you guys the Shutterfly story? So Jim Clark was the actually the godfather of Shutterfly, co-founder of Netscape before then. I knew him from Silicon Graphics. And when Shutterfly got started, he had two technical founders who I knew and liked. And so Jim Clark took me out to breakfast at Ilford and I said, "Steve, why don't you be the CEO?" I said, "Jim, I retired, and I really retired." He said, "Steve, I want you to be the CEO." I said, "Jim, are you retiring, really?" Went with Jim Clark. You had to say it at least three times. And then he went, all right, I hear you. Why don't you be the VP of marketing? "Jim, I'm retired. I have more money than you do." "No, that's not possible, Steve." And then we went into that story for a while. And then we're sitting in Ilford, Nile, and Jim, we're not even like two bites into our breakfast, and he's heard no's about three times for CEO, three times for VP of marketing, and Tom Wolfe happens to walk in. Anybody know Tom Wolfe? Bonfire of the Vanities, but he had just written he was researching his book on college. What was it called?
Charlotte Simmons.
Yes, Charlotte Simmons. And he was in Stanford, and he was all dressed in white and whatever. And Jim Clark said, "I'm done with Steve Blank." Stood up, left the table, went over to Tom Wolfe to get written into his new novel. The reason I'm telling you this story was Shutterfly, I did get involved I want you to be on the board or blah, blah, blah. I ended up being an early investor and on their advisory board. And this was the middle of the internet bubble. Now, anybody tell me what Shutterfly's business was in day one? Can anybody remember?
Pictures for you.
Over how?
Over the internet.
Great. So what did that require circa 1999? I'm sorry?
Broadband.
What else did it require?
Digital camera.
Okay. If you're a digital camera owner, what kind of digital camera did you have in 99?
The one that's very low resolution, probably.
Right. But you owned the highest resolution, low resolution camera at the time. And how many people had DSL at the time? How many people had ISDN at the time? Most people had dial-up modems. Now, I got to tell you, uploading pictures, even at crummy resolution, at dial-up modem speed, you could have watched paint dry. I mean, and paint drying was probably a speedy process compared to this. And you typically didn't want to upload one picture, right? I mean, you now have a digital camera. What did that allow you to do? Lots of pictures. You didn't take a roll. You took 100. Oh, man. What was the limiting factor on Shutterfly's growth in the first couple of years of the company's life? Right. Nothing to do with how good the service or the prints were. I mean, that was a tertiary problem. And I kept explaining to these guys, you don't understand. You could give this away. Our total available market is not limited to, you know, oh, we need to get big fast and what. And they were spending money. I think we spent $20 million on branding the first year. And that's when I resigned from the advisory board. That was my personal one-to-one experience with the internet bubble, which said, you don't understand. We could give this away now and we wouldn't have more. Oh, no, we're in a big competitive thing with, you know, who were the other people who Kodak eventually bought? Photo and Snapfish. And I said, guys, the battle is to keep our money for 3.5 years from now when the intercept, you can just draw the curve of communications and high bandwidth speed and digital camera resolution. It's all going to come together in 3 years. Why don't we park our cash? Because it ain't about us. We thought it was about us. It has nothing to do with about us. And the famous line was, Steve, you just don't get it. Now, luckily, Jim Clark kept writing $10 million checks every 6 months, and he would fire a CEO at the same time. So they were probably on series, I don't know, F, before they went public. And no one who owned any stock, except for the advisor, who had a non-dilution clause in his advisory board deal, because I understood this from day one, made any money at all from the first couple of years. My point is, Shutterfly was in a new market. Them and everybody else in their business was spending like they were in an existing market. Steve, you don't get it. We need to get 100% of all the digital camera people now. And went, well, what's the penetration of digital cameras in 1998? You know what it was? Less than, like, 2%. I said, well, why don't we worry about this when, like, the number crosses 25%, and that's kind of our sweet spot. Do you guys understand what I'm saying here? First mover advantage, new market, et cetera, it's the wrong time to be spending tons of cash. You want to spend tons of cash when you understand there's a little... Right. This is a new market curve. This is an existing market curve. By curve, I mean sales curve. In an existing market, we know there are customers. The only limitation is your ability to execute. In a new market, you're searching here. And you're hoping it looks like this. But by the way, every day, sales looks like this. So what you're doing is testing a whole set of hypotheses about customers and markets and product fit all the time here. How do you know about customers here? How do you know about customers in an existing market? You bet. Why? How can you do that?
Ask what their problems are, you know, what their needs are.
Yeah, how can you do that? You bet. I can't emphasize enough how the simple little test would have worked. What was the assumption in WebVan of who the customer was? Do you remember, Alexandra? Who was the customer?
Soccer mom.
Soccer mom. What should they have done? You bet. You think they did? No evidence at all after spending several hundred million, maybe, in fact, the number at WebVan, total public and private money, $800 million. Investors' money. $400 million from VCs. Another $400 million public capital. Fun exercise, huh? Question.
Yeah, I got a question. So, you know, in a new market, when do you start to spend dollars, or how do you go about educating the market?
You bet.
I mean, yeah. How do you work? You know, you want to save your capital at the same time. You think you got a product. You heard about the product. How do you do that?
So we're going to be talking about that in step three, customer creation, but I'll summarize it for you. It's an art. And I'm not being facetious here. This is why startups aren't about spreadsheets. They're about figuring out, do we have a repeatable and scalable pattern here, or do we have noise? And more importantly, I'll remind all of you, you take your customer development book, you lick it, you hold it up in the air, and you go, is there a bubble? If you're ever so lucky again to be in a bubble, you take that book, you whirl it around your head, and you throw it as far away from you as you can, seriously. In a bubble, for God's sake, cash in and flip in the bubble. This process, and your question, is about when there isn't a bubble and you got to build the damn company on first principles, that's what this class is about. And really, your question, which is the right one, is, so how do I know? And what I'm going to teach you through discovery and validation and creation is how to figure out when have I hit a scalable business model and how to do that on the least possible amount of cash. Right? Does that? And it's basically saying, just wait another couple of slides. And so, is that enough about WebVan? Did we beat this thing to death? Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Pooja, you want to tell us how much money Sequoia made on WebVan? Do you know?
We made none.
None? Didn't make anything? Didn't cash out before? Did you have a 6-month lockup or something?
I think eToys and WebVan are amongst the two biggest failures at Sequoia. We did not make
any. Really? Yeah. But Sequoia did fine in other things.
I don't want to say that one hit makes up for a lot of misses, but if you are a venture capital firm with 35 years in the industry, you can maybe weather losses better than others can.
This is poetically well said. Let's see if I can get these slides working. Let's see. This one? There we go. So, let's see what I suggest
we do.
And by the way, before I start, someone always asks me, so how long should this customer development stuff take? And the answer is, it depends. If you're in an existing market, that is, you're just about to make something what? Cheaper? New? What's an existing market? Somebody remember?
Better, faster.
Not cheaper, right? Resegmenting, we're either going to find a niche or a low cost. New, never existed before. Disruptive. An existing market, all you got to do is just check, make sure all your assumptions are valid. In new, oh, man, you're out in the land of the living dead here, right? And you need to spend some time through this process. Existing, somewhere in between. And for the discovery phase, again, could be very quick or it could take a while. And let me take you through what discovery is. As I mentioned, the methodology is customer development can take months or years. Each step has a set of phases. I hate to write. I really do. But in the beginning, before we start out, actually make everybody write stuff down so we know what our initial hypotheses are, what they should be doing, and how to know when we succeeded. And how do we know when we need to do more? Everything I'm about to tell you, they're checklists, but they're not commandments. Meaning, everything you hear or see in this class, they're rules of thumb. For your particular industry, your particular market, please convert them to your own. Don't go out and use the enterprise software startup checklist for your semiconductor company. Have people come back and tell me it doesn't work too well. There's another big idea, which I found out painfully. You taking money from an investor who believes you need to swing for the fences on day one, and you believe you need to spend the first couple months testing hypotheses, is known as an impedance mismatch. And investors tend to get rid of mismatches. So do not try this at home without having had discussions with your investors and board. If you're doing this from day one by yourself, before you have investors and board, great. If you're about to take money from VCs, see if your philosophy is compatible with theirs. 7 years ago, couldn't have found too many. Nowadays, or last year, you could have found, I'd say, half the VCs in the Valley. Now, everybody wants to be incredibly cautious. Or at least there isn't $100 million to invest in swing for the fences. But you really need to manage your connection with your investors. The second point we'll be talking about today is how you set up your initial team of the people focused outside the building. The first thing you tell me is, look at that, I built a great team. I got hired a world-class VP of sales, VP of marketing, and VP of biz dev. I think you're already screwed from day one. Because I don't believe, unless you're really in an existing market, that you need sales, marketing, and biz dev on day one. I believe you need to do customer development on day one, which is not the same. And so we'd be talking about the customer development team. I also believe the odds of a startup nailing or getting their hypotheses right in the first pass, I've yet to see it. And most startups kind of assume that everything will just happen per plan. And so you better be thinking that somehow you're going to have 2 to 3 passes at least of going through this. And then finally, modify the process for your company. The text was just my notes, actually, for my first class, written to describe what I did at Epiphany. It's for an enterprise software company. If you want to actually use this textbook as a guide for you, you're going to have to translate it into Web2OEs or Semiconductor-Es or whatever the equivalent is for your business. And so don't quibble about the details, but understand there's a process. Now, customer discovery is about hypothesis testing. And I think we talked earlier, where do hypotheses come from at this phase in a company when you start a company? Where do they come from? Your business plan, your ideas. So why do you want to test them? Chris?
Make sure it's worth continuing on.
Why else? Yes. Why else? What did we just see in WebVan?
verified they are accurate.
Yeah, why?
Well, because you end up making decisions based on those guesses or hypotheses, which, if they're not correct, then you're making wrong decisions.
And they cost you what?
Oh, I was just going to say, you can make really expensive mistakes.
Duh. Yeah. And in a boom time, what happens if you make an expensive mistake? In a bubble.
Maybe you don't have sight of those mistakes. So they can
right.
The
right. But what happens? Anybody know?
You get another round.
You get another round. What valuation?
Higher.
Right? And we're not even laughing, right? Of course, you're experienced now. Today, what happens? You're done. Right? Depending on, you know, how much your VCs love you, but I'll guarantee you it ain't an up round. In fact, it's probably not an up round where if you're out of money or you're not making money right now, it's triage time with almost every investor. Because their limiteds aren't making their capital calls. So we're going to talk about step one. The biggest idea for customer discovery is really hard for world-class entrepreneurs. And I'll give you an example. If you're a great entrepreneur, and I just pitched an investor my idea, and John Doerr or Mike Moritz just wrote me a check for $5 million, what do I think about my slide deck? Any idea? Joe, what do I think about my slides? I just got a check from a world-class VC. None of the good. God bless them. Personally, God gave me a check. Okay? Mike Moritz, John Doerr, it used to be, that was it. There is nothing wrong with my slides. It's the first thing I'll do then with that slide deck. Jamie, any idea?
You're going to delete everything you wrote on
this. Yeah, right, of course. I wrote them.
You're going to think everything is right and you're
going to change anything. Great, and then what am I going to do with those slides? Great, but what am I going to do with that slide deck? Thomas? And what am I going to do? Say it again. Right, same slide deck. Not only same slide deck, the only words I change are, instead of the last slide says I need $5 million, now it says I need your order. Trust me, I've done this in my career. I took the same deck, it's just been blessed by God. All those assumptions must have been world-class VC firm. Went out, started selling. Oops. That is, anybody ever do that? Or some version of that? Right? Got some investor excited, took your slide deck. It happens all the time. This is the hardest thing for an entrepreneur. Even after people have blessed your idea, even after you've raised money, is you need to shut up, put your slides away, even though your investors might be saying, build your company, hire your, get your building, here's the real estate, here's the lawyers, here's whatever. You need to stop selling and start listening. And the hardest thing it is to do is put your slide deck away and go back out and start talking to customers yet again. Because you now have a plan with a set of hypotheses baked in that you're about to dangerously execute. And you need to find out two fundamental hypotheses. What problem are you solving? And whether your product concept fits that problem. Yes?
So what's the dynamic, though? I mean, you just received this check. And now at the next board meeting, they're going to want to see that you're executing on that slide deck. It seems like it's a... and then now you go and explain, well, I'm okay.
Yeah. Right? If that's who you raise money from, put the book away and follow whatever orders they're giving you. Seriously. Can't go execute the book. If, in fact, you have explained to them, listen, let me tell you how I've been doing it so far. Let me tell you what I'd like to do again. I'm about to take a ton of money from you. What market are we in? If we're in an existing market, I just need to quickly validate this again. Gee, do we all agree that we're in a disruptive new market? Well, trust me, you really don't want me to be building a sales force, do you? And you know what? Nowadays, you can actually have this conversation about how to build the company and how do they want you to spend the money. I seriously meant to have this conversation first. If you take the money from big VC firm X, who may or may not have strategy X, but they will tell you what their management and investing and expectation strategy is versus Maples Investments. Anybody ever hear of Maples? At all? You'll get to hear about Mike. Mike's the kind of counterexample, where he lives and breathes customer development for Web2O deals. In fact, if you don't tell him you're doing this, he won't even talk to you. Right? So Mike's all about, prove to me you have a scalable market by, you know, I got 1,000 customers, then 10,000, then 100,000, here's how I'm going to prove it, and here are the steps, etc. It's very different from, I'm hiring a sales force and we're executing. Does that make sense? Yeah. This is truly a critical step. Because if you don't have that on day one, you truly get crosswise, because they are saying, where are all the people? Where's your lawyer? Where's the business plan? Where's the, you're supposed to be having this revenue model. What do you mean you're checking and testing more? It really drives traditional VCs crazy. So don't do this at home unless you've had that conversation. Now, this is great, by the way, to do before you ever get investors. Right? This is, in fact, nowadays, I don't think you could even get money unless you're somewhere about here. Right? For most, certainly in Web2O, and how many of you want to do a Web2O startup? Okay? I don't think you could even get funding until you got a couple thousand customers. Right? And that's going to require you going through discovery and validation, you know, by yourself or with friends and family or with credit cards or building it at home or dorms or in spare time or etc. Does that answer your question there?
Yeah.
So number one, stop selling and start listening. And two is test your hypothesis. And there's a whole list of hypotheses that the text talks about, but two for me are fundamental. And that is, what problem do you think you're solving? Because fundamental to any technology idea is we're solving a problem that someone has. It's either kind of important, sort of important, very important, or sometimes it will be immensely important, but they don't even know it yet. All of them are possible, but you have to be able to articulate, yes, that's the problem. Great, that's the problem. Get the hell out of the building and find me people who are actually agreeing with you. And then tell me that when you describe to them your product concept, they fell out of their chair and said, when are you delivering this thing? Customer discovery has four pieces. One is, I suggest you take a look at whatever business plan you've put together and you extract, not write anymore, but literally extract out of your business plan a set of hypotheses. Have you written a business plan, either in school or here? Right? Remember all the parts of the plan? Here's our business model. Here's our sales thing. Here's manufacturing, our revenue model. There must be 20 or 30 hypotheses built into the... How many pages was your plan? Did you do a plan?
About 20.
20 pages. There's probably one hypothesis that was worthwhile on every page. Right? The rest of it was garbage. Right? Anybody else have a bigger plan? Come on, some of you have spreadsheets 20 pages. Anybody have a longer? All right. You have hypotheses built into that plan. Throw out the rest of the plan and write down what the hypotheses are. Because that's what you need to do is get out of the building, test the problem hypotheses, test the product hypotheses, and verify, iterate, and expand. And there's a ton of other hypotheses. These two are critical. Distribution channel hypotheses, pricing hypotheses, competitive hypotheses.
What happens when you have a technology that is so new that even if you describe it, I guess the customer is, you know, they cannot tell. Or like, for example, the iPhone.
Right. Right. So those are new market businesses, right? And in new market businesses, we're really betting on your vision of how the market will emerge, right? That's what happened with the iPod. That's what happened. And now let's pick another new market. What's another new market?
Kindle.
I'm sorry, Kindle. Yeah. By the way, You know how many years have been the year of the ebook? Anybody know how many years it's been the year of the ebook? About 10. We're now in year 10. I mean, the path truly is littered. Anybody understand why the ebook might finally catch on? Anybody understand the key characteristics of the Kindle? Anybody know? Anybody want to take a guess?
It's just the way that you are able to read it.
Yeah, I think it's the screen. Yeah.
Book selection.
Book selection. How else?
Network connectivity.
You bet. Really, and probably maybe if this takes off, probably the only company that could have pulled it off. A, they own the content because for years they've been now slogging at every book supplier saying we'd like an electronic version. But do you understand it comes with a permanent connection to Sprint? You don't even pay a phone bill. You have no idea that this thing is on all the time. I mean, it's so transparent. You're permanently connected to a bookstore. Permanently. You can't even disconnect it. In fact, it's probably like taking photos of you at night. I mean, who knows what? It's probably sponsored by the NSA. They finally figured out, we don't need to bug your phone. We'll bug what you're reading and marking. You know, that's a pretty good idea. So in any case, it might have been that, much like, by the way, the iPod. What made the iPod successful?
iTunes.
Ooh. How many people were making hardware devices for years? Right. Turned out it might have been. I'm just suggesting it might. We don't know. I'm not suggesting you were wrong about the screen. But it might have been that what really took this thing to take off was the collection of pieces that everybody was kind of right, but it was the sum and the time. Might be. So in a new market, to answer your question, that really requires a lot of trudging around. And in a new market, it requires you, if you're telling me you're in a new market business, you take a pen, go up to the whiteboard, and draw me the market map of all the adjacent markets in a Venn diagram, and explain to me what has to happen for you to succeed in the center. Am I making sense? That is, you're not assuming that people will figure out something completely that never existed before, I think. You're saying that some behaviors will move from here to here to here to here, and something's going to happen that's never happened before over here.
But you don't have any hypothesis.
Oh, sure you do.
I mean, but how do you want to test it? You
cannot. Oh, absolutely. You could test it. What you're confusing is testing some hypotheses versus testing your absolute product or set of customer behaviors. And you'll see as we get in here, there's a ton of stuff you could test, right? You could test. Let me mock it up for you. What if I gave it to you? And you know what? And at the end of the day, you'll have a better idea than just spending $100 million building it. New markets are always a risk, but you will, in fact, get a lot of data by going out and testing, and I'll be explaining a little later what you're testing in a new market. But once you keep the notion of market type in your mind as you are, you'll finally understand, well, wait a minute. What I want to test in an existing market is very different when I want to test in a new market, and also slightly different than what I want to test when I'm resegmenting a market. Right? You can test cheaper really quickly. Hey, would you buy it if it was a third the cost? Absolutely. What if I took these features away? Still want it. But for new, well, imagine this thing you've never had before. Harder. But you could at least imagine, well, here, I'll shortcut this. Eventually, you're going to have a model of who the archetype of the customer is. Anybody know what the word archetype is? Tell me what an archetype is.
It's like
not
product.
Proxy?
Yeah.
Just what you meant to say, right? Proxy. So you might have in a new market that the proxy, my proxy of the customer is Sally. Sally is, let's use WebMed, soccer mom, you know, high-end income, shops here, goes here, etc. Oh, and my other proxy is Joe. And Joe drives a BMW and goes over here, and I believe Joe and Sally are good proxies for, and so I'm going to go out and talk to Joe and Sally's and ask them all about how they spend their money. That is, I could do a lot once I understand archetypes of customers, talk about how they use equivalent products, etc. today. Does that make sense? We'll get more into this. Questions? Sarah?
I think in any of the markets, there's going to be a gap in what people will tell you.
Absolutely.
What they do.
Absolutely.
What do you do with
That's why we're artists. No, seriously. A lot of this stuff is, well, I'm not going to get perfect information. Why the hell are you telling me to go outside and not get perfect data? You know, there is nothing about starting a company that's a guarantee, except one thing. If you sit inside your building, no, seriously, right, the antithesis to this, I know it's not the point you're making. If we sit inside and assume there is no great data we could get because it's not perfect outside, that's what big companies get to say. Startups can't afford to say that. And just I want to leave you with just with this idea. The hypothesis writing goes on inside the building. But that's the last time I ever want entrepreneurs spending time inside the building. In the early stages, my line is, there are no facts inside the building, so get the hell out. You need constant contact with customers, channels, and partners full-time outside the building. Sarah.
If you have a product that's very easy and cheap to build, better to just get it in front of people rather than doing the sort of surveys and talking to people and asking them?
So customer development is not about surveys. So let me be...
We're talking to people.
So in fact, thank you for helping me riff on this. I think I said it before, but just in case. The goal of getting outside the building is taking the product as spec'd in the minds of the founder or founders and seeing if there's a market and customers for the product as spec'd. Period. End of discussion. And if and only if you can't find a large market for the product as spec'd, do you go back with the approval of the product development people? Do you iterate the product? So you're not out there asking a super focus group of which features would you like. That is what large companies do. That's not customer development. That guarantees you end up with a feature list a mile and a half long and nothing that could be built in our lifetime. In this case, you're actually trying to minimize the first customer ship feature set. That's a radically different idea. And what you're trying to find is there a market for the minimum feature set? Sarah, keep going.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me.
But
understand all of that.
I wasn't saying that for you. It was just having to bring up that idea.
So I think it's a question of kind of adapting some of the ideas in the book to different markets.
Give me the market you're thinking about.
So I'm looking at doing some online workshops that I can create and have a website going in 2 weeks.
Great. I get that up tomorrow.
Great. So there's no point in that rate in asking people what they would do with this. Just get it in front of them.
And then
do some asking about what they thought.
So, for example, if you were telling me that's what you wanted to do, I would create 58 websites. 58 different prices. And 58 whatever. And every time someone clicked on an order, you'd say, hey, not scheduled yet, email me and I'd love to chat with you. Meaning, I would be using the sites not to sell a class, but to find out where the bounding box of your business is. Maybe, how much would you charge for a class?
$30.
Great. I believe you could charge $3,000. All you need to find is one, right? My point is on the web, you could do this just incredibly easy and with no cost to you to figure out where the bounding box of customer behavior is. Very cheaply and very inexpensively. That's different from, let me start a class and charge $30 and I'm done. Am I making sense or not?
Yeah, I think it's just that a lot of the stuff you're talking about here comes a little bit to the point in the process, the product development process,
Okay.
That makes sense.
All right. So author hypotheses, we talked about this. It's a one-time writing exercise. All their time spent in front of customers, it assumes you're smart but guessing. I mentioned the product hypothesis, customer problem hypothesis. Also, how much should I charge for this thing? Am I ever do pricing? Am I ever involved in pricing? How do you price a product? Huh? Really? Okay. How many believe you price according to value? Okay. How else would you price? Competitive pricing? Good. How else? Cost? Cost-based pricing? You bet. Willingness to pay. Happens to be mine. Can I tell you a pricing story? When we started Epiphany, I had no idea how to price enterprise software. Because there was one small problem. I started an enterprise software company and never been in the business. But I had heard, and it actually was true, there was a woman named Sandy Kurtzik who had started Ask Software, which she was one of the first women entrepreneurs, women CEOs of a large corporation. And they were making software for IBM mainframes that were manufacturing software, something called ManMan, which I used in the late 70s, early 80s. Since it was the first non-IBM enterprise software in IBM mainframes, she got her first potential order, but she didn't know how to price it. Must have been back in the mid-70s. And she's into this buyer, has a PO on his desk, but negotiating pricing with Sandy. She said, as the way she tells the story is, she didn't know what to ask for. But the head of manufacturing told the buyer to go buy this damn thing. We didn't care. It was the world's best piece of software. So Sandy says she goes into the buyer who says, how much is it? And Sandy gulped and picked the biggest number she thought like anybody would ever rationally pay and said, it's 75 grand. And she said, all the buyer did was write down 75 grand. And she realized, shit, I'm leaving money on the table. Sandy Kurtzik was awesome. And she said, per year. And the buyer wrote down, per year. And she went, oh, crap, what else can I? And she said, and there's maintenance. And he said, how much? And she's going, how much? 25% per year. And he said, that's too much. She said, 15%. He said, okay. So enterprise software got priced at 75 grand per year per module. Now, I have to tell you, when I started Epiphany, I had heard this story, and someone said, Steve, how much is your software? And I said, 75 grand per year per module. Now, fast forward to about 4 years later, I'm leaving Epiphany. We're about to go public like the next week. I did not want to be a Section 16B officer. I happened to be walking by a conference room. I mean, you know, it must have been conference room 702B then. I think we had 800 people. And I happen to be hearing a pricing discussion. And so I kind of stand outside. And they're arguing about, this is the pricing I had just made up like an entrepreneur because I heard this war story. And somebody was screaming, you can't change the pricing. It was calculated by, you know. And I'm going, oh, my God. You know, 30-year-old. Like, but the best Epiphany story, which I actually learned from a world-class saleswoman named Gina Ruan Miller. Brother Todd, her brother Todd was the first salesperson at Netscape, was we went into, I guess, AAA, CSAA in San Francisco. It was going to be our first multi-million-dollar customer. I went in with Gina, and they loved our stuff. It really was going to do them a world of good. And they said, how much is it? And I was about to go, 74, and Gina goes, shut up, I'm a salesperson. And she said, $1 million. And I went, and Gina's gone, shut up, I'm a salesperson. And the guy looks at Gina and said, Gina, you're out of your mind. You know, we don't pay more than $675. And Gina said, all right, let you have it for $675. And so here was the software I was about to let go for 75 grand. My first professional software salesperson just gotten 600. And she did the same thing. And she said, instead of per year, she said, but that's for the base module. What other ones would you like? And by the time we walked out, we got an enterprise software order for about $1.2 million. The point about pricing is, particularly if you're an engineer, it's very easy to underprice your product. Because you tend to value it on cost or need or what or competitive or whatever. And I finally, in almost every business, now work what I call a bounding box test, which is, how much is your product? It's free. It's Steve, you can't mean it. This is our fourth meeting. You know I'm serious. No. It's free. Assume it was free. How many would you use? No, Steve, how much? Assume it was free. How many would you use? Now, for enterprise software, does anybody know how you make money in enterprise software?
License upgrade.
Say it again. Yeah. Turns out for enterprise software, it was the number of seats you actually got deployed on. Yeah, you made money on maintenance later and whatever, but if you just got deployed on 10 seats in one department, it's not really enterprise, is it? It's like closet software, which I used to get stuck in too. You actually want to come out of the closet and be deployed broadly as you can. And the test for the products free was to test whether it didn't cost anything. What would it take to deploy it? And when I used to do that, they'd say, well, I didn't really tell you, but the IT guy really needs to approve this through the... Well, why didn't you tell me that before? Well, the product wasn't free before. I thought we were just going to put it on 10 seats. And so my point is, going to zero flushes out a whole set of issues. Other times, I'll go say to that same question, how much is the product? It's $1 million, Steve. We've been talking for, 3 months now. You know I don't have a budget for $1 million. And you get an answer sometimes just like Gina did. You know, the most we pay for this type of software is 500, 500 grand. Seriously. In a startup, you will find out by asking these questions continually what the bounding box of your potential revenue is. Do not be bound by what other people are charging. Anybody know where that science experiment is being run today on a much lower price? Anybody know? They might have a device in their pocket. iPhone. What's the price of an iPhone app? Do I know? I don't know. So there is a bunch of sites out there with some iPhone revenue charts. Right? It's kind of interesting to go take a look at what the right pricing for iPhone apps are. My observation is people are running bounding box experiments real time. Are they free and they drive other upgrades later, or are they charging $9.99 and making up and actually getting real value now? I don't know, but I'll tell you, people are doing those bounding box experiments. Am I ever do this experiment? Am I ever underprice a product in the marketplace? No. It's the Sandy Kurtzik number, isn't it? Right. Could be. Right. Anybody overpriced the product? No? Everybody priced their product particularly perfectly, and no one ever priced a product? Right. Yes.
I mean, how would we know? I've been book publishing for a long time, and I suppose so in hard copy books, we have a chance to find out.
Really?
Really.
So, anybody buy my book? Anybody buy it? Where'd you buy it? Anybody buy it anywhere else? How much is it on Cafe Press? $29. How many of you paid $39? Right? Do you know that the Amazon website outsells Cafe Press 10-1?
Most traditional publishers.
We're not talking about traditional. We're talking about entrepreneurs here.
Right, but just in that, it can be hard, I guess, to know sometimes.
And I'm just pointing out that there are ways nowadays to actually find bounding boxes for areas under the curve for revenue. Customer behavior is not always predictable. Another short war story.
Too many war stories? Or?
All right. So I joined a company called Supermac in the late 80s. It was a graphics board and monitor add-on to Macintosh computers. And they were very hardly struggling to be fifth in a group of three. I mean, if you parse that sentence, it really is kind of funny, but you've got to think about it, and probably not at 8 at night. But fifth in a group of three was really hard. There was a company called Radius and Rasterops, and there was Supermac, and these guys had just come out of Chapter 11, and were truly the sad sacks of the business. And I joined them because I looked at their revenue, and I looked at their graphics boards they had coming out, and I looked at their marketing department, and I went, something's going to give here, because they had some great products in the pipeline, and these were the, if there truly was the loser's battalion, It was the marketing department. I mean, it was true. And I'll tell you how bad it was. Is I was just in to sign my acceptance letter, and the head of Marcom, who was a wonderfully nice woman, ran out to me, was going to work for me, and said, listen, we got a really strategic decision to make here. I know you're starting in a week, and you're just here to sign your acceptance letter, but this is really strategic, and we need your advice. And I'm thinking, oh, man, a new like positioning platform, or we're really going to be thinking about who our customers are. And she said, we're about to spend $100,000 here. And I thought, oh, with some consultant, whatever. And she pulls out two logos, which were indistinguishable, at least to me. And she said, you need to choose between the two. We're redesigning our logos. And I looked at one, and I looked at the other, and I said, Candace, with all due respect, if this is the biggest problem the marketing department has, everybody ought to be updating their resume. And when I showed up, everybody was updating their resume, because she had spread that story. And so I came in, and, naive, I had never been in the computer retail business, and this is pre-internet, and the company sold its products through retail. I said, who are our customers? I inherited 14 people in the marketing department, and I got probably 16 answers, which was pretty hard because you only had 14 people. None of them were the same. So I went, well, that isn't going to work, asking our marketing people. And I asked sales, and I had different but more interesting answers and more informed answers. They were supposedly selling this stuff, but through a retail channel. So finally I said, don't we get registration cards back from customers? Oh, and somebody could answer that question. Why, yes, we do. Good. Where's the data? People started looking at their shoes. Well, we don't have any data. Well, do we have the reg cards? An hour later, they pushed in a cart. Remember those metal lab carts? You ever see any of those? 75,000 unprocessed, untouched by human hands, customer reg cards. First, I was pissed. And then I started laughing. Because here was untouched, raw customer input. I shut the door, and I put I'm busy, come see me after 4 p.m. sign on my door, and for 2 weeks, I did nothing but call customers. I wrote a questionnaire asking, how do they buy the product? What applications did they use? Who else did they look at? Blah, blah, blah. And in 2 weeks, I had the best profile of not only Supermax customers, but the entire graphics add-on market. I knew stuff my competitors didn't know. What I actually found out was they weren't buying it for 300 reasons. 89% of our customers were in color desktop publishing. Big idea. They only used three major applications back then, Quark, Photoshop, and Illustrator. Three is they didn't really care about the monitors, those big tubes. They were actually buying the monitors from whoever they bought the graphics boards from. And four, most important thing was, they didn't know we even existed. The only reason they were buying our products was they went in to buy our competitors, and some salesman convinced them to buy ours, as I found out later, because we were paying off the salespeople. Therefore, the 14 people I had outside my door were a negative drain on the company's P&L, because no one remembered any of our marketing or trade shows or anything. Holy cow. Now, just remember, I just started this company. I knew more than anybody in the entire industry. Just to give you the punchline, we took that company from 11 to 68% market share in 2.5 years. Took it out of Chapter 11 to an IPO, bought my first house. Okay, and we had the highest margins in the business. And I left after telling the CEO, excuse me, but it's exponentially harder to go from 68 to 69 to 70, and we need to get into the PC business. They kept saying, Steve, you're doing so well. We'll keep doing this. And I went, I'm leaving. And, of course, a year and a half later, they got bought by their competitors when they ran out of share. But here's a real-life example of using customer data, getting out of the building, and actually, stop taking excuses. So on customer discovery, you want to test a whole set of hypotheses outside this building. Regardless of market type, you need to come back in, share this with the product development team weekly, share it with your board, and start mentally building an archetype of who the customers are. I used that model before. I happen to like archetypes because what this builds up to you is, and again, the Supermac example, man or woman, color desktop publishing, using Photoshop, using Illustrator, would pay anything for speed. And, oh, by the way, I found out something, a marketeer, if they go their entire career, finds this out, extremely rare. You ready? They were price insensitive. Oh, my God. These people were price insensitive. They would pay anything for speed, and I was the only marketing person in the entire industry who understood that. That was worth an IPO. True. IPO. Because I understood, was able to take all this data, build an archetype of who that customer was, and market the hell like a rifle shot. Allowed me to stop doing the 27 other things we were doing. Allowed me to focus pristinely on how to get a consistent message out time and again. Product hypotheses, things you might want to start testing. Here are features or benefits or delivery schedule or IP or total cost of ownership, etc. Just as an aside, now do this as a sidebar. I've said continually, you don't want to hire a VP of sales or VP of marketing or VP of biz dev, unless maybe you're in the most extreme existing market. What happens when you hire a VP of sales in a startup? What do they want to do? Any ideas, Samir?
They
want
to sell.
And what else do they want to do?
Hire.
Because that's what you expect a VP of sales to do. What does that assume? Sorry?
The market's ready.
The market's ready for what?
Scale.
To scale. Think about this. Seems so obvious. The minute you hire a VP of sales to start staffing, you already have set a train in motion for you and your investors that equals burn rate. You hire a VP of marketing. What's the VP of marketing going to do? Anybody VP of marketing? Anybody want to be VP of marketing? I don't want to talk you out of it by now. It's actually a great job. Anybody in marketing? Come on, you can admit it. Hey, what is VP or what is a marketing department?
Start branding and educating the customers.
You bet. You bet. And maybe actually find something out about customers, but usually there's a whole set of, excuse the pun, collateral activities that are about execution, not about learning and discovery. And for, I know some of you are hiding in here as biz dev people, right? You want to go out and do deals. I'll contend that traditional organizations and titles fail in a startup. People equate their titles with their functions. And what I mean is, I've had this happen to me. I'm in a startup. It's chaotic. It's like being in a war zone. When I get confused, I look at my business card. My business card says VP of Marketing. I'm calm. I know what to do. Data sheets. PR. And when I'm really, like, nervous, hire an ad agency. But standard titles all describe this execution function. I'll contend just to break a bad habit, just to be radical, just to, like, make my point, we need new titles for the beginning of a company. And I'll suggest, here's the new titles, and they're all customer development titles. We need a technical visionary who could describe the architecture if this is a technical sale. Might be somebody who's eventually going to be the CTO or chief scientist. Could be the VP of engineering doing double duty. And you need somebody who can describe the business vision and then get out and do some business execution. These might be four different people. They might be just two people. Very rarely one person. Later on, they might turn into your VP of marketing or VP of sales or chief scientist. But actually might turn out to be the VP of biz dev or the head of product management or something else. And the reason why I insist on no VP of marketing and VP of sales and VP of biz dev titles is just to screw with your heads. I don't want you to do sales and marketing and biz dev on day one. I want you to do discovery and validation. And if you keep thinking that you're supposed to be doing sales and marketing, you're going to go out and do sales and marketing. Now, one of the things I've discovered is that your mother wants to know what you're really doing. No, seriously. So if you want a card for your mother and you're in one of my companies, I let you go tell them you're head of sales and marketing, but you're not allowed to say that. Or if you're going to call on large corporation X who gets very confused, you're allowed to lie and say, you know, I have this other card. But truly, you're not allowed to say that inside the company. Am I making sense? Is this making any sense at all? At least Sequoia's nodding. After all, wait till you change all the titles of all your people. So that's the end of the intermission. And by the way, this only lasts through the customer validation phase. When you start finding a scalable and repeatable pattern, for gosh sake, yes, we want to go back to silos. But right now, we don't know what we're doing yet. And so we want smart people outside the building, listening, testing, listening, seeing about the market, discovering, and trying to test our hypotheses as quickly as we can. And if you want to see what that list is, what chapter is discovery? Is it 3 or 4? 3. Go take a look at that innumerable list. Maybe I could slog through it. You're better than I am. I can't even remember writing it. It must have been on drugs. But there is an incredible checklist about the types of things. Somebody's actually, oh, look, there is a chapter 3 in there. I think I could have left page 48 to 112 empty and no one would have noticed. In fact, you would have paid extra. But if you look through those pages, you'll see a checklist of things. Then while you're out there, I will give you a good example. I remember that some of the most valuable meetings I've had were the ones that said no. Said no. I've learned that you never have a meeting, even when you're getting escorted out the door, without learning 3 things. What website do you look at? Read any newspapers? What kind of car do you drive? Any trade shows you go to? If you ask enough of these questions, remember, your goal is to build a model of potential customers, influencers, recommenders. And if you're just selling, you're not listening very, very well. Random pieces of data will come to play later on. Why would I care how someone buys? I sometimes ask, who's the best salesman you've ever seen in this business? Why do I want to know that? Any idea? Maheen? Yeah, why do I want to know that? Why else? You bet. They're on my list. How do you find out about new products? I always ask that. Why do I want to know that? I'm sorry?
Where do you go to advertise?
You bet. 6 months later, when I actually do start demand creation, guess what? I've now had 43 customers tell me exactly how to reach them. What do you most hate about people who try to sell your products like me? Oh, Steve, you're not here to sell us. You just told us you were listening for the last hour. Yeah, well, if I actually went to sell you, what do you hate? Oh, I hate when they do X, Y, and Z. Boom. That is, when you're listening, you're allowed to have a conversation you never normally get when you're selling a pitch. Does this make sense at all? And it's usually a relationship you very rarely have. Now, last 30 seconds, and I'll continue with this next week, because we're going to do discovery for a couple, I think, at least one more week. I used to love, this is before the internet, because people would say, Steve, I'm an engineer. How do I get a hold of these people? And, you know 6 degrees of separation, probably 3 degrees of separation from anybody in the United States. I'd ask my investors, my parents, my lawyers, my real estate people about how to connect to anybody. And just the thing I'll leave you with is, who do you think you normally want to call on in a company? Who's the first person you want to call on? Say it. Somebody said it. Right. Who thinks you need to call on the CEO? Come on. Who else? I used to think CEO, that's where I'm starting. Worst place in the world to start a customer discovery conversation. You want to start with the janitor. Janitor will get you the phone book for the company. And with that, we'll talk some more next week. So thanks.